In part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where jazz takes center stage in the original, improvisatory theatrical work, Lush Life, and Arts for Kids and Count Basie tribute performances by the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution honoring Sandy and Abby Hellman on their 40th anniversary.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this first hour, we will have the last of our series of candidate conversations for this election cycle. In the run-up to primaries and general elections, we have as many candidates on this program as we can. We invite them to be here to talk, not just to me, but also to talk to potential voters. We're pleased that in this hour, we will give you the chance to speak with Dr. David Gill. He is running for Congress for the U.S. House of Representatives in Illinois' 15th Congressional District. His opponent is Republican Tim Johnson. He's the incumbent, has been there for a while, and is running for re-election. He was here on the program on Friday to give you that same opportunity to talk. And Dr. Gill is good enough to come in here and do the same, spend an hour with us this morning answering questions. Now, I can certainly ask questions, but the important thing is that people who are listening, if you have questions, whatever issue is most important to you, that's your opportunity to call in and talk with him. Just a little bit more about him in terms of biography. He is a physician, an emergency medicine physician, makes his home in Clinton, Illinois. He has some involvement in politics. He has served as a Democratic precinct committeeman for DeWitt County for a number of years. And in his professional life, he's medical director working in the emergency department at John Warner Hospital in Clinton. He is also president of the hospital's board of directors. He grew up near Chicago. He attended the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign for both his college and med school. And other than 3 years that he spent in residency, his medical residency in Iowa, he's lived here in central Illinois for the past 25 years. And we are here again, as I say, and open to your questions. 333-9455, toll 3-800-222-9455. The district itself is very big, something like 10,000 square miles. And in case anybody's not quite certain about the dimensions, it includes a lot of territory, runs down kind of the eastern sort of border between Illinois and Indiana, and also includes Decatur, Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, Mattoon-Charleston, and Danville. So a lot of territory. Not a particularly easy place to campaign in, no. I would imagine, because of all the ground you have to cover.
It's kept me quite busy. I've gone through a couple sets of tires over the last 20 months.
Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here, David.
I think maybe I would start out talking about Iraq, because that's the place that we started when Tim Johnson was here on Friday. And maybe, unless you want to talk about it, maybe leaving aside the question of whether we should have gone in the first place, maybe I would ask you to talk a little bit about, since we are there, what you would like to see the United States do from this point forward, particularly around the question of how is it that we and under what circumstances we leave.
I would prefer to address whether we should have
you
been there in the first place, just
certainly
along the lines of it's my opinion that a lot of otherwise excellent people in Washington in October of 2002 abdicated their constitutional responsibility regarding the declaration of war, which I think was a shame on both sides of the aisle there. I think it's also pertinent because the voters have to consider what might come in the future with regards to keeping that responsibility. You know, there's talk about Iran and North Korea, and people need to be aware of the precedent that was set where Mr. Johnson and many others gave up their power to declare war and instead deferred to President Bush. And I think it's quite pertinent. As far as what I would like to see happen now, in traveling around the district, I've met too many grandparents and parents of young men and women that are there in Iraq, and parents and grandparents of young men and women who may well wind up in Iraq, to feel any way other than the fact that we need to delineate an exit strategy. I'm a believer that our involvement in Iraq has made the world and our country a more dangerous place. I think that it has served as a recruiting tool of sorts for Osama bin Laden and people that think like Osama bin Laden. And I think that it would be best if we begin to focus on exiting, in particular with a declaration that we have no designs on Iraqi oil facilities and a formal declaration that we have no intentions of setting up permanent military bases in or around Iraq. I think that if we were to take those steps, we would be much more likely to obtain some assistance with regards to reconstruction of Iraq from the United Nations and the League of Arab Nations and perhaps NATO.
You know, I guess I'm sitting here thinking on one thing I didn't do right at the beginning of the program was give the phone number, and maybe I better do that because I want to make sure that people know that we're here taking calls. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. You'd like to talk with our guest, David Gill, Democratic candidate for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. One of the other questions that I put to Tim Johnson and is one that seems to be a central question here is when and how do you decide to use military force? I know the president has outlined this doctrine that some, I don't think the Bush people have called it preemptive war, but a number of people have, saying that the United States won't hesitate to defend itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that means not only a real threat, but in a sense it also means a perceived threat, even if that threat is not a threat today. He mm-hmm. seems to be saying if that threat, we think it's a threat next week or next year or a couple of years away, if we think that that threat is real, then we're not going to wait for that enemy to strike us. We're going to strike them. And that seems to be the justification for being in Iraq. How do you think about that?
I think the key words there are if we think that threat is real. And there was enough doubt around the world and within this country with regards to the involvement in Iraq that it wasn't proved that that threat was real to my satisfaction or to many Americans' satisfaction and certainly not to the world's satisfaction. You know, I agree with Senator Kerry. He's been belittled for the comment, a global test, and I've heard it taken out of context many times by President Bush. We must defend ourselves if and when something does occur. But what he was talking about was this very question, when you would engage in a preemptive strike of sorts. And it's the type of thing when reasonable people from around the world recognize that, indeed, this is a gathering storm that will hurt Americans, if action is not taken, and that was not the case with Saddam Hussein, who had been thoroughly boxed in by the United Nations over a 12-year time period, and who was at complete odds with an individual like Osama bin Laden with regards to their way of thinking. To picture them as being in cahoots or some such thing, one being the most secular of individuals, and one being very religious in a disturbed type of way. There were red flags going off within my mind and as well as those of millions of people around the world.
We have some calls. Let's talk with them or let them talk with you. First, in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. I tuned in just a few minutes ago to hear your guest. Mr. Gill, Dr. Gill, excuse me, say something about to the military bases around Iraq, followed by then something about more cooperation. And I just wondered if that struck a note because it had been thought that if we could just keep our presence there without having our noses in their civilian lives so much that might be. But I'm actually asking what I missed, and with that I guess I might as well hang up.
Let me ask Dr. Gill, is the question clear that the caller said? Okay.
I think he might have not heard the initial part of it.
That's right.
We were talking about how we might exit from Iraq, and I think that I don't think it's going to happen under a second-term President Bush, but if we were to make a formal declaration that we did not have designs on setting up permanent military bases there and did not have designs on their oil installations there, that if we were to do those things, we might see a lot more cooperation in terms of coalitions willing to be of much more assistance than they have been to this point with the reconstruction of Iraq.
Well, you would, though, would you expect that there would still have to be some kind of American military presence there for some time? We might say this will not be a permanent presence, we're not going to build bases, but that we expect that for X number of years.
Or months.
Well, whatever, you know, whatever right. The time frame you think would be possible.
Again, I think as Representative Johnson has said very well on numerous occasions, he and I are not running for president. It's just a seat in Congress. Mm-hmm. And my personal opinion as a citizen is that the reconstruction there ought to be not under the auspices of America. You know, certainly our funding could be used. You could develop a Marshall Plan type situation, but I think it would be ideal if the League of Arab Nations or the United Nations would oversee the project as a whole.
All right. Let's talk with someone here on cell phone. They're next, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm going to change the subject.
That's fine.
Representative Johnson has talked about having a pretty good environmental record. I wonder if Dr. Gill could speak to that and just discuss the environment a little bit in general, since we're not hearing anything about it. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Certainly. Many, many times I have to listen to people say Mr. Johnson has a pretty good environmental record for a Republican. And when you look at his voting record as measured by the League of Conservation Voters, Sierra Club, et cetera, over the last 3 years he's had 64% rating, a 25%, and a 75%. And to me, that's not good enough. I think we need individuals in Washington who have 90 to 100% ratings, which is what I'm certain I would achieve if I were to go to Washington. The environment is very important to me. And, of course, not having been a public servant other than precinct committee man and having served on the board of our city-owned hospital in Clinton, all I can tell you about is my own personal life. For 2 decades, I've recycled every 2 weeks, and I enrolled my son the day he was born, my firstborn, in the National Arbor Day Foundation. You know, those are the types of things I've told crowds during the campaign, that my wife insists on buying recycled paper goods from a company called Seventh Generation, who get their name from an old Iroquois Confederacy saying, which is that every decision we make must take into account the impact that it will have 7 generations down the road. And I'm a firm believer in that. And Mr. Johnson's right when he says that when you don't have a record, then you can say about anything. But that's how I've lived my life. That's how I feel. And that's how I would intend to vote in Washington on a much more steady basis than Mr. Johnson has.
The next caller is in Belgium. That's line 4. Hello.
Hello, sir. Mm-hmm. Since the last election for president, we've had a definite upturn in the type of warfare that we have. And it's totally different from what we faced before in that it's an asymmetric war, in that weak people are fighting against a very strong nation. And we have these hideous things that go on all over the world, including here. 9/11 is exactly the same thing. People who did not have enough power found an ugly way to hit us. Now, sir, it seems to me we're going to have to make some fundamental changes in the way we look at the rest of the world in the next election cycle. Are you willing to do that?
Oh, very much so. I think that, that I should have prefaced my remarks on Iraq by saying what I do think is that our involvement in Iraq does not equate with the war on terrorism. I firmly understand that there is a war on terrorism that needs to be fought aggressively on our part. The perpetrators of 9/11 need to be brought to justice. Those who would repeat 9/11 need to be dealt with in a firm manner. It's just that I think the wrong way to fight terrorism is to invade a country that wasn't involved in the actions of 9/11 and was essentially made impotent over a 12-year time period by U.N. sanctions and inspectors.
Oh, what I'm getting at, sir, is that we ourselves fundamentally have to take a different look at what these people are saying to us with these actions, in that we may not like what they're saying, but we at least have to come to grips with what they are saying.
I agree very much. I think that's a large part of what I'm talking about with Iraq. You know, and when I talk about Iraq serving as a recruiting tool for Osama bin Laden, he's able to point at what we've done there and re-emphasize the whatever points it is that he has been trying to make.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, sure. Thank you. Do you think that the United States was right in going into Afghanistan?
I do. I do. I think we should have done it quicker. We gave them a 6 to 8 week head start, and I would support even further involvement there, given that Osama bin Laden is still producing videotapes being shown around the world. We've done less than what we ought to have done with regards to those who were responsible for the damage of 9/11.
The next caller is in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, so I'll go ahead and ask them and then take my answer off the phone. The first one has to do with corporate or business fraud. There's an article in this morning's Wall Street Journal. The headline says, "Email suggests Merck knew Vioxx's dangers at early stage." And this seems to be emblematic of what's going on in the business world. And it seems to me that very little is being done about the corporate fraud. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say about that and what you would do if you were elected. And my second question regards the documentary that was aired by Sinclair Broadcasting. Here locally, they own WICD-TV, and I decided to go ahead and watch it and see who the advertisers were. And I noticed that you ran an ad during that documentary, and I wonder why you chose to do that. So I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Certainly. Part of my campaign has consisted of trying to reach out to Republicans and independents. The way that map was drawn that David was discussing at the start of the hour, it was drawn to make this a Republican district at baseline and was very effective at that, to the extent that I received no assistance from the National Democratic Party or the State Democratic Party. And in acknowledging that, there are certain realities one has to deal with. And very early on in this campaign, I'm not a politician. I'm just a citizen like yourself. And I recognized the reason I ran for Congress was because I'm a firm believer that we need a national health care plan in this country, and that myself, as a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, can help to provide that with the plan that they advocate. And health care is an issue that cuts across all boundaries, left-wing, right-wing, young, old, and we wanted to make sure to reach out to the Republicans and independents who are also getting crushed with their health care financing and let them realize that they had someone here who has the answer, I believe. And part of that strategy was recognizing that Republicans might well be watching that program. It's based on everything I read about it. I didn't watch it. We anticipated that there would be Republicans watching and wanted to make them aware of me. And in particular, the ad that we ran on that show is a commercial which begins with a gentleman who is a dyed-in-the-wool Republican who also happens to be a Gill supporter. And we wanted to let the folks that were watching that see that it's okay to be Republican and vote Gill. In fact, it likely is to your benefit. And I've gone to lots of Chamber of Commerce meetings and Rotary Club meetings. And usually the hour starts with people laughing and saying, "We haven't had a Democrat in the room for 25 years or some such thing." But by the end of the hour, in talking about health care, a fair portion of the audience comes up to me with a smile on their face and stating, "Yes, indeed, we do need to do something about this. And this sounds good, what you're talking about." So I am aware of the fact that people were boycotting that station and that program, but I felt it was an ideal opportunity for someone who was given very little chance of winning this election to reach out to people whose votes are needed.
Okay. And the other question he was having you talk about corporate, you know, the issue of corporate misconduct, corporate fraud,
yes,
and so forth.
It's a problem. There's no denying it's a problem. It needs to be dealt with in a very firm, punitive manner. We treat white collar crime in this country much different than violent crime or so-called blue collar crime. And I think as a society, we pay a price for not taking it seriously enough. And whatever issue related to that was to come before the Congress, I would be firmly in favor of dealing with in a very firm manner, in a very serious manner.
We're getting close to the midpoint here. Just for anybody who is tuned in, I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Dr. David Gill. He is running for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. His opponent, the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson, who was here on Friday to do this same kind of program. He lives in, that is, Dr. Gill lives in Clinton, and he works in the John Warner Hospital there in Clinton. He's a medical director who works in the emergency department. He's also president of the hospital's board of directors.
David, I'm vice president now.
Pardon me.
Yes,
pardon me.
The website hasn't been updated, but I had too many irons in the fire and decided to move myself down a notch.
Well, I can understand that. You'd have your hands full trying to do those two things. He is here and would take whatever questions you have. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go on next to, we have some other callers here. They're all in Urbana, the next three, and the next person in line is number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I hope the doctor gets to talk more about health care because I'm extremely interested in that. But my specific question has to do with environment. And I'm wondering if the doctor has specific initiatives. I guess one of my main concerns are alternative energy uses, mm-hmm, so that we're not so dependent on oil. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you.
I agree wholeheartedly with you. I spent a full day down in Mattoon this past April at a wind energy conference, and I am a big proponent of wind and all renewable fuels. I've listened to Mr. Johnson for several weeks now talk about the energy bill that he voted for that made it through the House and not through the Senate. And while it has some admirable statements with regards to biodiesel and ethanol and wind, I think it doesn't go nearly far enough. And what it also does, what I never hear him talk about, is the $11 to $23 billion in your money, taxpayer-funded subsidies, that goes to big gas and big oil. And I think that the environment and energy are inseparable, and we need to really change the way we look at our energy policy. And we need to do so promptly. It's not something that we can put off until 2020. You know, we're reaching a point where things are becoming very difficult with the Chinese purchasing ever-increasing amounts of oil each month, the cost of oil up to $55 a barrel, the environment, which cannot continue to be overloaded with the debris of fossil fuels. And so I'm in complete agreement with you. The technology with wind energy has changed substantially over the past decade, and we could do a terrific job with that resource alone. If you were to put $11 to $23 billion into helping out our farmers with setting up two or three wind turbines on their land, you could make a tremendous difference with regards to the way things go in this country. And not only would it help that farmer and society overall, it would also be good economically. It expands the tax base and creates jobs, and I'd like to see us heading in a different direction other than giving $10 to $20 billion to big gas and big oil, in addition to which that energy bill really shreds many of the environmental protections that have been put in place in this country over the last 30 years. Based on my reading, it's the big energy all but held the pencil as they wrote that bill.
Next caller is line number 3, also Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Earlier you referred to John Kerry's statement about that our involvement in Iraq should pass a global test. Now, this has been referred to a lot by the Republicans, and mainly they don't seem to understand what he meant by that. There's a rather eloquent statement which was made many, many years ago in a slightly different context, which I think can be used to refer to something like a global test. And I'm surprised that nobody has mentioned it to my hearing before. It goes like this: course of human events.
And it's tough. I've learned being on the campaign trail myself, you have to put things in little snippets sometimes, and perhaps Mr. Kerry could have put it much more eloquently, but I think that was well spoken.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is line number 2. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I did not hear the whole show, so perhaps you have already done this. And I want to start by saying that I am a Democrat, and I always feel that's appropriate to say when I talk to a candidate so everybody knows where my questions are coming from. But could you take a few minutes, and it seems to me in the past few minutes that I've been listening, you sort of have done that. Can you list your point of view and where you disagree with Tim Johnson? I just heard you do it on energy. I wonder if you could key in on some other things where you just simply disagree with Tim Johnson, the current representative.
Where do I begin?
Exactly.
We disagree very fundamentally on health care. He does acknowledge that there is a problem with the financing of health care in this country, but he has spent a good bit of time in recent weeks bashing the type of single-payer national health care plan that I've been advocating for many years in the past nearly 2 years as a candidate. He feels that it would reduce flexibility when, in fact, the plan as devised by Physicians for a National Health Program would increase flexibility. You would be free to go to whatever hospital and whatever doctor you want, which is not the case today under the rule of the PPOs and the HMOs. He states that it would reduce healthcare quality, which is almost laughable. I respect the man, but I don't think he has the expertise with regards to healthcare issues that I have. And you can't do much worse than spending twice as much as every other country and being ranked 37th in the world by the World Health Organization in terms of quality. That ranking is largely because everyday people just can't get the things that they need. He talks about waiting times in Canada, ignoring the fact that the plan that I've proposed is an American plan run by American healthcare providers and healthcare consumers. It's not government run, as he has referred to it. And it would continue to be funded at the same level as today. If the Canadians were to double their healthcare investment dollars tomorrow, some of the flaws that are present there, and they are not nearly as significant as Mr. Johnson would have you believe, even those flaws would go away if they were to invest themselves fully. What my plan does is put your money actually into healthcare rather than into bureaucracy and the profit of people who know nothing about healthcare. So we disagree on healthcare substantially. We disagree on energy, as we referred to. We disagree on taxes. As a member of Citizens for Tax Justice, I'm well aware that what has been passed since Mr. Johnson and George Bush went to Washington, those tax cuts have overwhelmingly favored the wealthy. They've left us with a sea of red ink, which is unconscionable in regards to how that's going to impact our children and grandchildren. I was just over at visiting with a class of fourth graders here in Champaign, and they asked me about taxes, and it's sad to look at them and recognize that they will be the ones responsible for the party that has been thrown in Washington since January 01. So I would like to reverse those tax cuts as they apply to those doing very well in our society, those making $250,000 a year or more. Last week in Charleston, Mr. Johnson had a misstatement in a televised debate. He stated that my Project Vote Smart website, that's a questionnaire you can fill out to make people aware of where you stand on different issues. He stated that I indicated that I would slightly increase taxes on those making $25,000 a year or less, which goes against everything I've ever stood for in my life. And I said, no, that's not the case. And he said, oh, you better check your site. And indeed, I was right. It says that I would not increase those people's taxes. And I don't know why he said that on television, but that goes up into the Champagne market. So I'd like to make that clear to those who saw that show. I don't know if he's reached what level of desperation he's reached, but that point should be set straight. So we disagree on stem cell research. I'm an advocate of all forms of stem cell research. I think to turn our backs on that is a mistake with all of the tens of millions of people who may potentially benefit from that, people with neurologic disorders as well as juvenile diabetes. I could go on and on.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. We have certainly time for others. Our guest this morning is David Gill. He is a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives from the 15th Congressional District here in Illinois, running against Republican Tim Johnson. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. If you'd like to call with a question, toll free, 800-222-9455. Particularly because you have made healthcare a central issue for your
yes.
campaign, and we did have an earlier caller saying she was interested in hearing about that. I just wanted to make sure I give you another opportunity, if you want to talk about basically what it is that you're suggesting for healthcare reform. Particularly
sure.
One of the things that we come back to again and again is that there's a very large group of Americans that have no healthcare.
Right.
And the last time I looked at it, I don't know, what is it now? 44 million, 45,
45.
Million, something like that.
And it's the scope of the problem is overwhelming. It's not only is it those 45 million and 90% of them are working full time, it's the very many people who have insurance but have to deal with premiums and copays and deductibles that are skyrocketing on a regular basis. And the solution as offered by Physicians for a National Health Program is a plan which has been through the Congressional Budget Office repeatedly, always receives rave reviews, and they indicate that the country as a whole would save upwards of $300 billion a year. 95% of households would save substantial amounts of money. It's a tax-based plan, but it's a tax cut, if you will, of sorts, in that you'd be paying much less with this tax, which some people say ought to be 2% on individuals. Much less in that tax than you're currently putting in today in terms of premiums and copays and deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses. It would allow for all needed care for all Americans, including long-term care for our seniors, prescription drugs, acute illness, chronic disease, mental health care, which so many insurance companies seem to drag their feet on funding, and preventative medicine, which is so vitally necessary. And it would reduce bureaucracy. We'd go from 1,500 different health insurance companies to one insurance company, which would, those savings alone, healthcare economists from of all political persuasions look at the savings of going from 1,500 to one and streamlining down from 1,500 different forms to one set of forms and recognize that the savings involved in that alone would cover the 45 million people who have no health insurance. It should have been done 50 years ago, and there are 126 people in Congress who have signed on to this type of plan. It's not some pipe dream on my part, and I look forward to being number 127 if the voters so decide tomorrow, and hopefully speaking with a physician's voice who's lived in the trenches of medicine for 16 years, hopefully being able to lead others to recognize that this is something they need to do for the vast majority of their constituents.
When you look at all the things that go into the cost of healthcare, one of the places where the costs have gone up the fastest, maybe it is the place where the costs have gone up the fastest, is prescription medication. And
yes.
That's what's driving this this debate now about whether or not people should be able to go to Canada
right.
to buy their medicines because they're less than if you buy them here in the United States.
Right.
Is that something that the government that is the cost of prescription medication. Is that something that the government can and should do something about?
Yes and yes. It would be, if I had my way, it would be wrapped up within the national health care plan that I'm talking about. The pharmaceutical industry is the either the first or second largest lobbying group in Washington, which reminds me that last week Mr. Johnson said on your show that he gets the majority of his funding from individuals, which is not true. We have documentation about that. The bulk of his comes from political action committees. And they, the pharmaceutical industry, is the largest stumbling block toward putting through the type of plan that I'm talking about. They give a lot of money to a lot of people in Congress, and their profit margin is unlike anything anybody else sees in their business. It's a problem that is really, it's hurting everybody. Big business is being hurt. Small business people are being hurt. They're unable to compete on a level playing field with the rest of the world. Labor gets hurt as well with health care prices that go up 5 to 10 times the rate of inflation for all other goods and services. So it's something that we need to get done, and I would look forward to helping. With regards to the importation of drugs, I think that that's fine, and the arguments against it are very disingenuous, but it is just a Band-Aid for a gaping abdominal wound that needs to be fully repaired.
Do you think that people, if they are, however they're doing it, buying their prescription medicine from outside of the United States, have some reason to worry about the safety? Because that seems to be the primary objection of the FDA to doing this. They're saying, well, we can't assure that that what it says on the package is in fact what it is you are getting.
Right. I would say that the FDA has, while it's illegal, they've permitted it for 11 years. They haven't taken any action, so you wonder if their concerns regarding safety are real. And I would just be certain that what you're buying is actually products that are manufactured and packaged here in this country, the same as what is sold in this country. For the most part, that's the case. I've heard anecdotally one or two episodes of, and we might see more of people trying to cash in on this in some criminal manner. But for the most part, if you can identify your prescription medication as being the same stuff as you would buy right here in America in terms of manufacturing and packaging, I would hardly give that a second thought.
Okay. Well, we have some other callers here, and we'll get back to with phones. The next person is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Gill.
Hi.
I have a question because it seems that even here locally there's a shortage of either physicians or a very high turnover, especially for doctors that deal with mental health. We've been dealing with it for more than a year or so. It seems like you can barely keep a doctor for a year before they decide to leave the clinic that they're at, and then you have only a child psychologist or a child psychiatric doctor left to deal with all the adult patients. Mm-hmm. And it concerns me that if we manage to get health care coverage for a greater portion of the population, what kind of pressures it will put on the existing systems and how you would see we could meet the need and the extra demand that would happen?
Well, there might be extra demand in that sense, but there would be reduced demand in the sense that you'd be able to manage things preemptively or preventatively. There's rarely a day where I don't see a patient who's coming in with a disaster going on with their coronaries who's had ample warning. People experience 10 minutes of chest pain frequently when they're active, and then they rest and it goes away and they don't address it, oftentimes because of the bills that they fear they might incur by addressing it when it's something that can be managed in a more reasonable way, or people with high blood pressure, which is a risk factor for coronary disease, who can't afford their medications. So when I talk about the Congressional Budget Office reviewing this plan, they have experts in these types of issues who look at it and take into account all of those types of savings to be had on the front end, as well as some of the increased use that might occur. You would also reduce the volume of non-emergency situations that we see on a regular basis in emergency departments around this country,
mm-hmm.
People who have nowhere else to turn for their health care, because the first question they get asked by many doctors' offices is, what kind of insurance do you have? And mm-hmm. so ER care is the most expensive of all.
The way to get care, that's the most pricey method.
Right. It's tremendously cost inefficient, and I would hope that when we have this program in place that you'd have much better availability and funding of mental health care.
So you would foresee that people might change their habits and then make access to the system in a more appropriate manner in terms of seeing a regular family practice doctor and
exactly
and getting the medical attention that you need.
Right. When they have the U.S. health card, when everybody has the U.S. health card, things will be much more appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to next caller, line number two. This is someone also in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. This has got to do with the environmental issue. A few years ago, I think it's been about 5 years ago now, and it doesn't look like things have changed. There was a construction site not too far from our home, and these trucks laden with soil were going back and forth, you know, going one way with soil and coming back empty for days and days, and they were spewing out the most terrible, you know, air-polluting exhaust I have ever seen in my life. And I called and did get a hold of the EPA office, and they say, well, you know, cars are regulated. I said, if I drove my car and it did that sort of thing, they'd have me pulled off in nothing flat, and I couldn't drive it till it was fixed. Yet they said trucks are exempt from this kind of air pollution. Is that correct?
I've heard people say that before. I'm not sure to what extent. I think they might not be exempt, but they might be held to a less stringent standard.
And well, it's considerably less stringent, is mm-hmm. all I can say. And I really would, I think that's probably one of the worst environments. Oh, we had to pay several hundred dollars after they were done to have our house washed because it was so bad. But I'm just throwing that out as what
sure.
I think is one of the worst polluting elements we have are these trucks and buses.
That's important, and that energy bill doesn't address our need to demand more fuel-efficient vehicles.
Well, they need to put scrubbers on them or something, but thanks for the call, and thanks for enjoying listening to your program this day.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on again. Another caller here. This is line three. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I want to tell Dr. Gill that I find everything you say so comforting. I've been living in Illinois just 1 year, and I would find it extremely comforting to have you representing me in Congress. Everything you say, I agree with, and I would love to. I hope that health plan gets a lot of attention.
We've tried to make it get a lot of attention to the best of our abilities.
Well,
your words are very flattering.
But I also have a question on an entirely different subject, and that is there anyone in Washington who has even thought of simply talking to Osama bin Laden or communicating with him? How do you see the recent release of that tape? Does it seem at all like a tentative attempt to communicate, to say, let's talk and let me explain why we thought it was a good idea to bomb the Trade Center? And then is there anybody who sees another solution other than bombing people and threatening to kill them?
Not that I've heard. You know, I haven't heard any talk like that in Washington.
Sure.
I do think I think that what he spoke last week was much less pompous sounding and arrogant. And I don't know if he was trying to engage in dialogue or if that was to serve as further recruitment of the more moderate element of people in that part of the world. But he did make reference to what happened in 1982 in Lebanon. And I think that
that's right,
we should bear in mind that, and far be it from me to really give the man any credence, but separate and apart from what he said, it brings to mind the fact that I'm a believer that we need to have a Palestinian state, that we need a two-state solution with regard to the Israelis. And that's another area of disagreement between my opponent and myself.
Well, I realize it's not going to be easy, but if we don't talk to people, then I just wondered if there were anybody in Congress who believes that dropping bombs doesn't solve anything.
Well, I think there are many people who probably in a general sense feel that way, but he's done a pretty good job of vilifying himself within America and in much of the rest of the world. Remember, we had tremendous sympathy for our cause on September 12th, 2001, and it's only since that time that through the involvement in Iraq, for the most part, that we've lost that sympathy and gained a large measure of negative feelings.
Yes, we've lost a lot of friendship around the world. The first thing I remember about, I'm 81 years old, so I remember several wars, and I remember noticing John Kerry. The first time I noticed him was when he spoke for Veterans Against the War, mm-hmm. and I thought, what a brave young man. And I'm going to vote for him. I'm disturbed every time I hear him say, we're going to seek them out and kill them.
Mm-hmm.
We can seek them out and find out, you know, how can we talk to each other and make peace, but to threaten to seek them out and kill them seems to destroy any possibility of communication.
Well, I would agree with that. If they're killed, there won't be communicating going
right.
on. I think there are some things, and again, I can't speak for John Kerry, but there are several issues where I think that politicians, career politicians, there's a calculation to everything that they say, and they need to make sure that they ensure that they get 50.01% of the vote, and I think some of what he talks about with regards to that is not so much with regards to what is the right answer as to what is the way that I get into the White House.
Yeah, because you can't do anything unless you get elected. Well, thank you so much for taking my question.
No, it's my pleasure.
Troubled.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We'll see if we can get at least one more. The caller next is in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Dr. Gill.
Good morning.
Thank you for running. My question is about the flu vaccine shortage.
Mm.
I understand that flu kills about 36,000 people in the United States and a million worldwide.
Yes.
Every year.
When we have vaccine available.
When we have vaccine available. And CNN and other news organizations are talking about a pandemic.
Yes.
Which occurs, every 20 to 30 years. And the flu strain changes.
Right.
So that people have little immunity from previous flu bouts. So could you talk a little bit about how we can keep a sufficient supply of flu vaccine and what we can do in the way of policy to help us be more prepared?
What I would say and what I've been saying for the past 3 or 4 weeks is that with a national healthcare plan, we would never have a shortage of flu vaccine. The reason that we don't have manufacturers of flu vaccine in this country is that it's not profitable enough. Last year, 4 million doses had to be disposed of because they didn't get used, and that cuts down on profit margin. When the focus is on the well-being of people rather than the maximizing of profit, then you would see plenty of flu vaccine. In fact, I find it ironic, my opponent and many politicians knock Canada and some of the European countries, but here in our hour of need, that's precisely who we're turning to because they have national health care and they have more than enough flu vaccine available.
Well, I do appreciate your cogent thoughts on the matter.
Thank you.
And hope you get to Washington to help us out. And I'd like to just say one word of appreciation for Governor Blagojevich, who has really stepped up in this flu vaccine shortage to try to get more vaccines available for Illinois, the citizens of Illinois. I think he's done made an outstanding effort.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. There we will have to stop because we've used our time. And our thanks to our guest, Dr. David Gill. He is the Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives here in the 15th Congressional District, running against the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson.
Thank you, David. It goes fast, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Uh-huh. We appreciate you being here.
It was my pleasure.
Our show today, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, and Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes. The broadcast is also made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, they'll be looking for your questions on diet, nutrition, and exercise. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat, founder and owner of Nutrition on the Move, will be the guest following the 1 o'clock news. She's generally on the show each month to take those sorts of questions. So whatever's on your mind about those subjects, you can call in. The program itself, the Afternoon Magazine, begins at noon with news from NPR, BBC, and AM 580. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Coming up in the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about the Electoral College when voters around the country go to the polls tomorrow to select senators and congressmen and people for their state legislatures and the president. There is, of course, going to be one very big difference between the way that we select the president and the way that we select everybody else. And that does indeed have to do with the Electoral College, which is a rather complex system and may not elect the candidate who receives the most votes, which is, of course, what happened in 2000. The question a lot of people are asking is, should that be changed? Well, I have two guests this morning who have two views on the Electoral College, one of them making the case for change. That's George Edwards from Texas A&M University, and arguing to keep things as it is, John Samples, director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute. So that's coming up in the next part of the show. And, of course, you can call in with your own questions. Right now, though, we'll take a break. We'll have news and an update on the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And with this update on the markets at 10:59.